What is happening around the world with private military contractors, with North Korea, the situation still in Afghanistan? Up next, Robert Young Pelton joins us, an adventurer on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Robert Young Pelton. First of all, he became the inspiration and role model for a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He's an author, journalist, filmmaker, photographer, adventurer, philosopher. Robert has trained Navy SEALs in survival, participated in secret special forces training, and motivates young people to do meaningful things with their short time on this planet. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. What times we're in, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing good, George. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. What's your take on this whole North Korean situation?
Well, it's like a bad TV movie because if you've seen the propaganda films they're putting out and all the staged photographs, you swear this is a Mel Brooks film that you've seen, but you don't remember quite when it came out. But essentially, you're looking at one of the last holdovers of the Cold War, you know, and war was on in the 50s, and we bombed the bejesus out of North Korea, and they froze at that parallel. So ever since then, North Korea has been living in the 50s and 60s using the threat of American attacks to keep the population in check. And we've, you know, frozen the DMZ, and we've basically never finished that war.
And now they have nukes, and are they crazy enough to use them, Robert?
Well, I think they are. You got to remember that they have nothing to lose. I mean, the leadership of that country is very similar to Saddam Hussein and some of the older dictatorships, where to stay in power, they can do whatever they want because there's no one there to regulate them. They do have nukes. They don't go very far. And obviously, we have an entire military that's perfectly trained on how to handle Cold War tactics and armies. But it's brinksmanship. You know, it's like the Cold War. You would make threats. You'd sort of rattle your saber, and then you would say, okay, I'll stop rattling my saber if you give me $10 million to feed my people. So it's all posturing and show business.
I have the feeling this Kim Jong-un wants to put the money in his own pocketbook rather than feed his own people. What do you think?
I don't know what he can buy. You know, there's not a lot of Walmarts in North Korea. But, yeah, obviously he does just fine. His country doesn't do that well. They slowly were thawing out there for a while. You know, they had tours. You could go to North Korea and take a tour. And they were starting to think about, well, maybe this isn't so bad. And I think that's why they came up with this new sort of harder stance. But you got to remember, this recent bout of aggression was actually started by one of our military exercises. So he didn't start this recent round. We did.
Well, that's true. I have thought that since his father died, he was put in, but is being propped up by some military people who are running the show. Is that a pretty accurate guess?
Yeah, I mean, you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your relatives. I don't think he was groomed or bred for a leadership position. And I think the oligarchy is very tight on who runs the country. There's some fascinating stories about some of the people that have disappeared, some of the high-ranking generals that vanished. One apparently strapped in with a suicide vest and blown up to make the point that don't mess with young Kim. But I think what you're seeing is much like Russia and other countries that have sort of the old guard that's ruling from the shadows.
I think so, too. And he's like the PR front man.
Yeah, he does a good job because he looks just like a cartoon character. I
mean, he does. He does. And he does strange little things. I mean, his actions are weird. I mean, he just doesn't look like a leader. I don't know. It's a weird thing. And this thing with former basketball player Dennis Rodman is bizarre.
Well, that was a genius. That was Vice Magazine. You know, a couple of Canadians did that for their HBO show, and that was pure genius. And I still think the great leader thinks that was Obama. Nobody just told them, that's all. But that was a publicity stunt done by Vice Magazine for their new show on HBO. So I thought it was very well done.
Why would he seem to be so friendly to Rodman, and then all this would come right after that?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, Rodman is, I think, one of the first celebrities to actually go on a tour. It was also a couple of the Harlem Globetrotters.
Right.
And it was, you know, he likes spectacle, and I think he likes sticking it to the U.S. So, you know, if Obama won't phone him and be nice, then he'll talk to Dennis Rodman to show how easy it is to get to Korea and how nice he is, and of course all the pageantry and sports. So I think it's just a well done sort of PR thing.
If you're President Obama, would you trust this guy?
You know, I don't think we care. I think he causes great consternation. But you know, my friends are up at March Air Force Base that did the military exercise. That's all they do is plan how quickly they're going to take out North Korea. And our equipment, as you saw, whether it's the stealth bombers or missiles or Navy or whatever, can literally obliterate all Soviet-era equipment within minutes.
Well, that's true. And would we have any hesitation, Robert, using it?
You know, with Iraq and some of the other wars we've gone into, we always win. It only takes us a couple of weeks to win. So hopefully we learn by now not to hang around too long.
Well, see, that's the problem. We can't run these countries. And, you know, I'm convinced, for example, looking at Iraq for a moment, that when we went in there, rolled through there, won in just a matter of weeks, never saw any soldiers. I mean, they were all gone. We were never confronted at all. I think they just took their uniforms off and went, and then they're the ones that started creating the problems afterward.
Right. Well, also the fact that Paul Bremer fired them had something to do with that. The entire Ba'ath Party, which included both active members of the government and retired people on pensions, were simply cut off and made impoverished. All the soldiers, I mean, when I was there during the opening days of the war, they were all living like homeless people in bombed-out buildings. So they were the ones that started the insurgency.
They were ticked off, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, then quietly they brought them back into the fold, and that's basically how we turned down the level of violence there.
I've been reading a book on Cuba and how all that unfolded. And I was going to say I'm amazed, but I'm really not anymore, at how our government and the people that have been in government all these years can manipulate countries for their own good. It's truly amazing. I mean, during, you know, my father was in World War II, Robert. If I had told him the things that I've learned over the years now that we all thought were conspiracies, he wouldn't believe me. I mean, he was a World War II veteran. Everything was God and country. And the mere fact that there would be behind the scenes things going on to control and manipulate, he would not believe me.
Well, you got to remember that was a conscription war. We've had, you know, Vietnam and World War II where everybody chipped in, and now you have a volunteer army. So it's the military actions that we do are somewhat separated from the bulk of the population. If they insisted on a draft to go in and do these things, you'd have a very different political climate back home. We wouldn't spend 10 years fighting a war.
No, that's absolutely true. Where are we now? And we'll get into Afghanistan in a moment. Where are we with Iraq? They say the troops are out, but I'm sure we've got a lot of advisors there. What's going on there?
Well, Iraq refused to sign an agreement with us that would allow our troops to stay there. So it technically it made use of force in the presence of U.S. soldiers illegal in Iraq. And Iraq is still, you know, torn apart by sectarian violence, Shia against Sunni. It is a stable country, I guess, you know, in quotation marks. But it was supposed to be our launching platform for Iran, and we were supposed to use huge bases like Balad to use as a forward operating center if we wanted to go into Iran. We've sort of changed our mind, and now we're looking at Afghanistan, and we're still waiting to sign that agreement with President Karzai, who's holding out on signing that. But we have Bagram, which is a huge military base now, which would be an excellent forward base, plus Shindad, which is right on the border with Iran on the western side of Afghanistan. But I think we're still negotiating the return of U.S. troops. And when I mean troops, I don't mean fighting, but, you know, on bases using basically the Air Force as the main presence,
right,
and drones and things like that.
I mean, do we even know how many people are over there, troops?
No, because it's not just troops. You know, every time there's a military engagement, you know, for every one soldier you see on the ground, there are hundreds that trail all the way back to the States and, you know, supports, contractors, whatever. We technically don't have many troops, if any troops there. But in Afghanistan, for example, we're winding down the troops you see, but we're going to keep at least 30,000 troops, and we're probably going to have 60,000 contractors.
Yeah, tell me about these contractors. I mean, you've got a lot of experience in that arena. I mean, is that a growing field?
Well, you know, I first found out about contractors when I was looking for bin Laden on the border, and I bumped into this sort of forward operating base that was full of civilians and some military. And I was quite surprised that civilians were working for bin Laden, or at least out there on the frontier.
Yeah.
And then a number of my special forces friends started working for these companies like DynCorp and Blackwater and SAIC and whatever. And I suddenly realized that what they were doing was they were retiring out of the military, and then they were going right back into the same job, but making about 2 to 3 to 4 times as much money doing the exact same thing.
Same
plus
thing.
They would get, you know, vacations and spend
6 months. Bonuses and everything else, yeah.
Yeah, and then what happened is that we started hiring contractors just to do things like truck convoys and, you know, guarding warehouses in Iraq, and we had to kind of scrape the bottom of the barrel. And that's when you started hearing about these stories about, you know, shootouts and drunken fights, et cetera, et cetera. But the contractors were always supposed to be an old boys network, where when you got a little bit too beat up to be in the military, you'd come right back in, work a desk job, and make lots of money.
And you had a job waiting for you, probably.
Yeah. Now, the problem is, and I don't know if it's a problem yet, it is so easy to hire contractors because they're invisible. So when I was in Afghanistan doing missions with special forces, I was surprised at how many contractors are integrated into the fighting force. And these are civilians. These are not people with uniforms, but they do things like intel gathering, and they provide training and servicing equipment, et cetera, et cetera.
Are they working hand-in-hand with our troops? I mean, do our troops,
absolutely.
So they know who they are, right?
Well, absolutely. And not only that, but they're older, more experienced troops. So it's not like they're strangers to the combat arena, but they're doing very specialized technical jobs, whether it's running drones or, you know, doing interrogations of prisoners or whatever. And they all work for large sort of alphabet companies like SAIC would be one, the DynCorp, Mission Ready, things like that. And the idea being that they're supposedly cheaper, but now they're actually the main source of our talent. And I don't mean to say that the military is not talented, but I mean, if somebody has to move quickly, for example, a bunch of my friends went to Mali and that region to set up a drone base, they use contractors because they can call them up and they can be there with exact skills, and then they can send them home, and nobody knows about it.
Is it legal to use these contractors?
Yes, it's actually one of the more restrictive areas because there's massive amounts of paperwork as to what a contractor can and cannot do. You know, can he carry a weapon? Where can he travel to? Does it stay on base, et cetera? So, I mean, they're because of all the controversy over the last few years, they're a very regulated group of people.
Well, and this is happening worldwide, I assume.
Yeah, and this is a return to the old proxy wars because, you know, you have to look at it as layers. So people I'm talking about are Americans, ex-servicemen, sometimes ex-cops. But then there's a layer called third country nationals, and these are people from Gurkha. I mean, they're Gurkhas from Nepal, or they're Filipinos, or people who make a lot less money but are doing a lot of things like static security and things you don't even notice. And then there's the third level of contractors, which are the local nationals, which are essentially like hired armies that do the basic level of security. So these days, you can fight a war in Somalia, for example, and people don't even know we're fighting a war there because it's so outsourced and it's so layered with proxy armies and contractors and trainers.
This October, we would have been in Afghanistan for 12 years.
Yeah.
12 years. I mean, if the American people had known when we went in there to get bin Laden, where, you know, everybody was supporting that move for the moment, I don't think they ever would have accepted that.
Well, if they would have told the truth, because everybody knew that bin Laden was in Pakistan. You remember the whole Tora Bora thing. We knew
right
that bin Laden escaped into Pakistan, and we should have said, time out. I mean, we're in the wrong country. Let's keep going into Pakistan. But magically, we didn't. Had we done that, we would have ended the war a lot quicker. Now we're a lot smarter, but unfortunately, it's too late because now Karzai and the U.S. is negotiating with the Taliban to bring them back.
Yeah, why are we doing that?
You know,
is the old keep your friends close but your enemies closer?
No, I just think it's a political move. I mean, what President Obama is good at is removing political risk. And he knows that when Americans get killed overseas, regardless of the purpose, it damages his political approval. So he's shutting down the visible sides of these wars. So just, you know, as an interesting thing, I was in the war in 2001. with a special forces unit that fought on horseback. I went back with the same unit 11 years to the day. And it was somewhat symbolic to me because it was all new people, all young guys, you know, eager, well-trained, smart guys. We have the world's best intelligence system. We can find people within minutes using electronic, human, or whatever. So we had the capability to fight the war very efficiently. But yet they had never even met General Dostum, who the first Special Forces team had been assigned to. So I had to make the introductions to the Special Forces team to this well-known political figure, and it was like a homecoming. But I just thought, isn't that weird that we've been there for so long, and yet we don't even know what's going on there?
That is weird. Well, now, were you private or military at the time?
No, I'm just me. I'm not. I've never been in the military.
As adventurer Robert Pelton, doing your thing.
Well, I was hanging out with Dostum because he invited me into the war, and he happened to have 12 Special Forces soldiers with him and two JTACs from the Air Force. And at first they were told they can't talk to me, and they were even talking about, well, you know, should he be restrained? And then they suddenly realized I knew more about Afghanistan than they did, and we worked together and we became great friends. So,
did you support the initial go in there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd been with the Taliban, you know, in the mid-90s, and I knew what they were up to. I knew that they were sort of incompetent hicks, that they had the best of intentions, but they were so backwards. I mean, so unequipped to do anything politically. And they were basically tools of Pakistan. So it was a move by Pakistan to get control over Afghanistan.
I mean, they were the Mujahideen, right? The people we supported to get the Soviets out.
Yeah, well, most of them were Pakistani Afghans. You got to remember that most of these Talibs, you know, Mullah Omar and people like that, came from Afghanistan, but actually grew up in the refugee camps in Pakistan. And so when they went back into Afghanistan, most of them were illiterate. They had no training, no education. They had no skill sets. And some of the Taliban were very educated, and some were complete boors. But the problem is when they went up north, and you got to remember they were Pashtuns from the south. When they went up north, they started slaughtering the Hazara. And I went to many places where they burned people alive in their houses and
because
of their religion, you know, Shia versus Sunni. So the problem is, and this is what you're going to see in the next couple of years, the North is going to refuse to let the Taliban come
back
in.
Yeah.
So even though Karzai is trying to get him back in, even though the U.S. is trying to get him back in, the North will fight a civil war.
It's going to start all over again.
Well, it's already started, actually. I mean, it started about a year ago. And you have these little flare-ups as the Americans leave. You have, you know, Afghan-on-Afghan violence, not necessarily Taliban, police fighting against the military, Pashtuns fighting against Hazaras, et cetera, for control. So as we leave a vacuum, these people are now fighting over who controls that area.
Before 9/11 occurred, just maybe a month or so before, wasn't there an Afghan northern leader who was assassinated?
Yeah, that was actually 2 days before 9/11. That was Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was also a friend of mine, but he was the leader of the Panjshiris, who were in a little valley just north of Kabul, and they were the last group in that area. It was General Dostum and Massoud were the last people fighting against the Taliban, and the CIA was working with Massoud at that time.
They needed to get that guy out of the way first, then.
That was one of bin Laden's gifts, was to kill Massoud using a couple of Tunisian and Algerian
cameramen, right?
Yeah, pretending to be a cameraman. And when they did the interview, boom, he was dead. So that was bin Laden.
And the cameraman, I assume, went with it.
Yeah, well, one ran away and then they shot him, but the one guy blew up instantly.
Yeah, unbelievable. So on one hand, you know, we support going in and doing this, but then we stay too long and we try to figure out why we're still there.
Well, here's the
thing. You at that point, too?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Nobody owned the war. The really unfortunate thing about how Americans fight wars is that we don't put people in place for long periods of time. So, for example, when I was there in 2001, you know, I made a lot of friends. Those friends are still there. Now, the American soldiers and the commanders and the generals, you know, they come in for 2 years, 4 years, or whatever, and they're gone. So the institutional memory disappears.
Let's talk about the exit strategy, Robert, when we come back. We're going all around the planet tonight with adventurer Robert Young Pelton here on Coast to Coast AM. If you have a moment, get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at our clip of James Van Prague and me as we talk about Beyond Belief, the television show. You can take a look at that. And if you're interested, there's a link right by the highlight reel. Just click that. You get 10 days free, and you get to look at all these videos as well. And that's at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Young Pelton with us. Started his own magazine some time ago, by the way, called Dangerous Magazine. He needed a place to publish stories, couldn't find one. So he started his own magazine. That must have been fun, huh, Robert?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of people that I know enjoy adventure and doing things that are kind of cool. But magazines obviously need advertisers, and they don't like things that are dangerous. And so I gathered my friends together, and I thought we'd start publishing stories about what it's like to do really cool things that people used to do and still do at dangerousmagazine.com. So it's free. People can read it. And someday I'll figure out how to make money on it. For now, it's just fun.
All right. Good for you. Exit strategies. We never seem to have one, do we?
Well, we do. It's the Russian one. The exit strategy in Afghanistan is essentially take X number of security personnel per population, train those people up, pay them for a couple of years, and then get the hell out of there. Now, the problem is, mathematically, in Afghanistan, there aren't really enough people to meet the criteria for a normal soldier or a police officer, and there's even less money. So we've created this sort of 400,000-man security force that looks like an army, looks like a police force, but is actually going to tear the country apart because we're essentially arming people, taking them from villages and saying, here, go fight the Taliban. And as soon as we leave and stop kicking them in the butt and say, get out there, they'll go back to their village with their gun and they'll protect their village. So it's just for appearances right now. And I have to say that the commandos in the Afghan Special Forces are quite good, very well trained, you know, the best of the best. But they have no air support. They have no medevac. They have no intel support. They don't have any of the things that our troops have. So when they go out, they get ambushed just like the old days. You know, they fire a rocket at the last vehicle, trap them in a mountain pass, and then pick them off. So it's like the old days.
Do they like us?
They love us. I mean, this is the joke about Vietnam and Europe and Afghanistan and Iraq. Once Americans are face to face with people in other countries, they all want green cards. They all want to come and live in Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles. They've all got family here. You know, we create this weird sort of barrier by saying, oh, the Afghan, why do they hate us? The Afghans hate us. No, they don't hate us at all.
Well, and the Iranians don't hate us.
Well, Iran is like Cuba. You know, it's one of these, North Korea, Cuba, and Iran, people always tell me, well, it's dangerous. And I used to put them in my book for fun, you know. Cuba is where you go on vacation if you're Canadian. It's a place we're going to nuke if you're American. You know, Iran's the same thing. We're going to nuke them. You know, they're going to attack us. And you go to Iran, the people are very friendly, they're very nice, and they wonder why you people are so mad at us.
Yeah. And you know what? Most of them would love to get Ahmadinejad out of there and the mullahs.
How many people like their government? I mean, we complain about our government
all the time. That's right. That's right. Well, we can see what happens with their upcoming elections eventually, and who knows? Who knows?
The problem is that the Iranians are somewhat xenophobic, and the main contention is Iran versus Israel. I mean, when we talk about things that are going to heat up over there, you know, when we talked about Saddam's Scud missiles, Scud missiles only go 400 to 600 miles, which means they can probably hit Israel.
That's right.
So nobody's launching missiles at Detroit or Chicago. So we tend to project this sense of fear and loathing. But what's happening now is quite the opposite. I mean, you're seeing this Arab Spring and the revolution in Syria slowly bringing more and more fundamentalist Sunni elements into the Middle East. So what we planned is actually happening to the opposite effect.
It's not working, is it?
No, we were trying to moderate the Middle East, and now it's getting even more polarized.
I mean, they want to go to, what was I reading? They want to overthrow the Emirate of Dubai now and take care of that?
And think about that. When you go to Dubai, it looks very nice. It's full of tourists. Their military, they have a special forces unit, and that's it. I mean, you know, 20 guys with a pop gun could probably take over the United Arab Emirates. There's really nothing. It's like Kuwait. You know, everybody heads for the discos in London as soon as you make a noise.
You're right. You're right there. I don't know if in Dubai, what are they doing? Buying people off in order to stay safe?
Well, they have a lot of training agreements with foreign countries, of course, and they've set up military units of foreign soldiers like Colombians, but that's only 800. They really are in trouble. If Arab Spring starts up, they really, really are in trouble.
So what do you see as a tinderbox right now, Ron?
Well, the tinderbox right now is the evaporation of the middle class, and that sounds very boring, but what you're seeing is the sort of the bedrock of stability, which are homeowners, people who go to work every day.
You're talking about here, right?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about all around the world. I'm not talking about just in America.
All right.
I'm talking about the erosion of that dream. If you work really hard, you get to have a little plot of land and
a little house and a little car.
Yeah, and these things have vanished. And what's happening is you're developing predatory governments and systems, like you saw what happened in Cyprus, where suddenly the government decided that we're going to take some of that money out of your bank account, because even though you didn't read it, we actually own your money once you give it to a bank. That goes right to the heart of what a government's supposed to do. A government's supposed to protect you, not prey on you.
That's right.
So if you talk to Americans, if you talk to Afghans, if you talk to Singaporeans or whatever, the biggest problem is that it's quite expensive to be middle class. So you're either wealthy, which means you own property and you have money in the bank, or you don't. So what you're seeing in the Arab Spring is the predominance of young people who don't see any future, you know, have no jobs, will never buy a house.
No, they don't have anything.
Right. They're rioting in the streets, and they're breaking things, and they're shooting things. And this is the most dangerous trend in the world right now, is the next generation not having anything.
I agree. And it's growing here, too, where younger people are the highest percent of the unemployed.
Right. And look at Afghanistan, which we think is alien and strange. Afghanistan has experienced an extraordinary brain drain right now. All the young people that worked with Americans, that had jobs because of the aid money, they're gone. They're getting visas. They're going to Belgium. They're going to Denmark. They're getting the heck out of there as fast as they can. And that's what's going to plunge Afghanistan back into the Stone Age.
Well, and other than the poppy seed, what's the industry out there?
There is none.
No.
The one industry was called Uncle Sam, and that's it.
So, I mean, there's no hope for most of these people.
Well, there's no jobs. There's no factories. I mean, they're talking about mines. They're talking about, you know, developing things. But it's a kleptocracy. So people steal things as fast as they can because they know they have to get out of the country.
Give me your perspective, Robert, on where you think this is heading worldwide. Is this all leading to a one-world government, a new world order, in order to contain what could very well be a planetary-wide uprising?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't want to sound like conspiracy nut, but, you know, we've talked about many countries, but we've talked about the same problem. The haves are grabbing onto their stuff. They're hiring private security. They're protecting their assets. The governments are preying on the poor people and the people who aren't smart enough to protect their assets. You can't go to a policeman and say, no, you can't do that. You know, in most countries, the authority of the government is absolute, and the government is usually controlled by wealthy people. So you're seeing very much a situation that's set up to create a revolution. I mean, violent overthrow of countries. Now, when you talk about a global government, we have that. If I go to Dubai and I want to set up a bank account, they tell me to get the heck out of there. They will not do business with Americans because the controls on the money, whether it's $20 or $20,000, creates this huge reach from the U.S. government into their banks. So there already is that world control over either my taxes or my money or my travels or my activities. If you broke the law, George, I could tell exactly what flight you took, where you went, where you were talking on your cell phone, where you spent your money with your credit card,
amazing,
who you talked to on Facebook, and I can get you within seconds.
That is amazing. Why can't they find then Mullah Omar or Zawahiri?
Well, Mullah Omar is in Karachi, and Zawahiri is up in the tribal areas. So it's actually not that difficult to find them. Joseph Kony's in the, you know, Central African Republic. They just gave up looking for him last week.
Why?
I don't know. I find these people all the time, and that's one of my specialties, is I literally go to the place and say, where is he? And people point over there.
And then you get out.
Well, you know, I usually interview them, or I spend time with them, whatever. But the point is that it's not that difficult to find people if you actually look for them. The question is, why aren't we looking for them? If we know that Mullah Omar is in Pakistan, we know the Taliban is based there, we're talking to the Taliban who represent Mullah Omar, and you tell me that we can't trace one phone call back or one link back
right
to Mullah Omar?
Well, that's the same with bin Laden. Come on, it took that long to find him?
It took that long not to find him,
just
the way I look at it. So we have certain agreements with countries that allow them to do very bad things to our troops in Afghanistan, which is another reason to get out, because, you know, if Pakistan is supporting Hekmatyar, Haqqani, the Taliban, and we're in peace talks, then we're wasting our time.
Do you trust Karzai?
No, of course not. I mean, Karzai has gone from a very meek, sort of mild nobody to learning how to play the game very well, and his family's become very wealthy, and he is working very hard to hang on to power even longer. He's, you know, he's like every other person we created.
No, you're right.
At a certain point, he abuses that power.
Like Noriega, all those people.
Exactly.
And then they turn on us. Happens time and time again.
Well, this is the problem with American policy. First of all, when we pick somebody, it's not done by the people. It's done by some group in Langley who says, well, this guy, you know, we can work with this guy, and he speaks English, so we don't have to hire a bunch of interpreters. We put him in power. We tell him to behave himself. He does, and then he suddenly realizes that everything in the country goes through him, and he can make billions of dollars if he just keeps quiet and kowtows. The fascinating thing is that Karzai's turned against us. You know, he's spoken out many times against the Americans being the cause of violence in Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera. Well, he masterfully played all that into a seat at the bargaining table with the Taliban in Qatar, because the Americans had set up the Taliban office in Qatar to keep Karzai and Pakistan out. But because he caused so many problems, we had to let him back in.
Isn't that interesting?
It's silly.
Who handpicked Karzai? The Bush administration?
Well, no, Karzai was we called him the doorman, but he was essentially the Taliban's. He was Mullah Omar's first pick for the U.N. representative in New York back in the 90s.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, his father was an ardent supporter of the Taliban, who then turned against him, and they thought Karzai was very cool because he spoke four or five languages, and he seemed like a nice guy. He was then wooed over to the agency side when his brothers, who ran restaurants in Baltimore and the Washington area, went to the agency and said, hey, why don't you have this guy Hamid go in? He's from that area, and he could probably talk to the local elders. So they sent him in with a special forces unit. They dropped a bomb on themselves. They had to rescue him. They sent him back in, made him look like he actually fought in the war, and then made him a leader. It's a very funny story.
That is weird. Okay. And then there he is. He's been there since the inception. How long can he stay in there?
Well, the last election was very funny because I was there for the last election. Karzai, it cost $10,000 to buy a voting booth in Afghanistan. That means that everybody that works there during their lunch hour will fill out all these cards with, they don't need photographs of women, so they just use a thumbprint, so they actually put their thumbprints on there. So $10,000 for every voting booth. And then he went to the north to Dostum and said, hey, can you work with me on this election? I'll give you 12 seats. So Dostum spent $250,000, Karzai spent $250,000. Karzai got 45% of his clean votes from the north, and then he screwed Dostum over by not giving him any of those 12 seats. So he's a good politician, I have to tell you that. But the north is going to break away from the south because of that. They don't trust Karzai, and they realize that if they don't look after their own interests, and the way you can tell is that a number of enemies have got together to challenge Karzai, and that includes the Taliban, Haqqani, and some of the people from Hekmatyar's party, and people like Ustad Atta Mohammed in Mazar, who hates Dostum, and General Dostum and Ismail Khan. All these people have all banded together, put aside their differences just to get rid of Karzai and keep the Taliban out.
Who is running the poppy seed production out there, Robert?
Well, that's down south, and that's usually run by Pakistani businessmen. And what they do is they put in orders for, it's gum, it's like a sticky opium gum that has to be scraped by hand. So opium is always grown in the poor areas because it's all harvested by hand. It can't be done by machine. And that is then shipped into Pakistan, and sometimes it goes directly into Iran. If it's further south on the border, they'll run it straight into Iran, and it goes up into Turkey and gets turned into heroin.
What's your take on Musharraf trying to get reelected in Pakistan?
I think he's going to get shot. I don't know what
he's pretty bold right now.
Well, you know, he's always been kind of a tool of the U.S., and sending him back is very strange because he's already in trouble. I mean, he's already been called before a court to answer on charges of overthrowing a legally represented government. So he may get hung. I mean, he may get put in jail and hung by the neck.
That's possible. He's risking that, isn't he?
But he wouldn't be the first CIA guy that had that happens to. So,
I mean, do they force him to go back?
I think these people get bored watching TV all day, and so they get a bunch of money from the agency, and they go back, and they figure Everybody loves him, and when they get there, they get arrested and put in jail.
Yeah. Well, they haven't arrested him yet.
No, but I mean, people don't like him. It's not like he's a popular. He's an ex-military coup leader. You know, he was not elected by any Pakistani that I know.
No, that's true. What's going on in Syria?
Oh, Syria is probably the biggest single problem we have right now, and it's probably the most depressing war I've ever seen. It's, you know, Syria is a beautiful place. I don't know if you've ever been there, but the city of Damascus, the old part, and the people there were very friendly. It was a very strange sort of what they call rogue nation because there were no American products there. So it was kind of cool. It was very, authentic and untouched by tourism. And then what happened is they started fighting. And Assad, who's considered a moderate, believe it or not, took a hard line. And I think that's because of the Russian support he had. He used a lot of Russian tactics. And so now what you're seeing is tanks running around these beautiful neighborhoods in Syria, just flattening neighborhoods, and something like 200 people a day dying in these shootings. Yeah, and that, you know, 70,000, they guess, they don't know, 70,000 people have died so far. It's all little itty-bitty militias. There's no sort of government or structure.
And he won't give up, will he?
Well, he doesn't have to. He's in charge. I mean, this is the funny thing. You know how PR works, like propaganda. You know, back in the day, he was our guy. He was the moderate guy. He was right next to Israel. He wasn't going to attack. He didn't like Israel, but he wasn't going to attack him. And now suddenly he's like the next Saddam Hussein. And he's being fought mostly by foreigners. I mean, he has some legitimate concerns that all these foreigners are pouring into Syria to fight under fundamentalist flags. So the thing that we went to Iraq to get rid of, you know, the Al-Qaeda, and the thing we went to Afghanistan to get rid of is growing like weeds in Syria.
They're trying to get him out.
Well, no, that's irrelevant. That's right next to Israel. I mean,
that's the problem.
Yeah, you're talking about Wahhabist, Saudi-backed Wahhabist militias with no government, no control, right next to Israel. And where do you think they're going to go next?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But at the same time, I mean, he is killing innocent people, right?
Yeah, it's inexplicable, but yeah, he's taking that hard stance of sending his military out and just flattening neighborhoods, dropping bombs, I mean, just using all kinds of horrible things on his own people. And you got to remember, though, that Assad's family are Alawites, which is a branch of the Shia. So this is the same Shia-Sunni thing going on, and this is why they're pouring so many Sunnis into the fight and so many Wahhabist and fundamentalist units are fighting in that area. But, you know, if you read the news about the American that was fighting over there, Eric Haroon, he had no idea. He got hooked up with an outshoot of Al-Qaeda, which we supposedly got rid of.
What was he even doing there?
Well, we're doing our latest issue of Dangerous Magazine is about strange people fighting and doing things in Syria. So we have, you know, the war tourist, the young journalist, the aid worker who uses Kickstarter. And one of the guys was Eric Haroon we talked to. It was basically like a party guy who decided to go fight in Syria, got into a fight, ended up being with al-Nusra, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda and an official terrorist organization, took videos of himself, and then suddenly realized what he was doing and hoofed it out of there after a month, went to the FBI after he talked to us and said, oh, my God, I think I screwed up, thought he'd come clean. We went to the consulate in Istanbul. When he went in there, he had done an interview with an Israeli journalist who goes under the pseudonym of Ilan Ben Zion. And on his Facebook page, he had the only good Zionist is a dead Zionist.
Oh, geez.
So he got rolled up by Israeli intelligence, who broke into his Facebook account, started publishing these pictures, and then started writing about him as an Al-Qaeda fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalist, et cetera, et cetera. And the guy is not. I mean, he likes to drink. He likes women, all that kind of
stuff. Hold on for a second, Robert. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're going around the world here with adventurer Robert Young Pelton talking about things that one day will affect us. We'll be back.